League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird, and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Jamp and Luke Cutfer.
Hello.
Hi, howdy.
This week, we're talking about the death of the dinosaurs. But first, we have a review from Apple. This one is 5 stars, and it says, "Great listening. My husband recommended this podcast to me because of me pursuing a conservation bio degree, and it is so informative and fun. Such a well-spoken group with good chemistry and great information. Highly recommend."
I love reading out of the comments. That's so nice.
I wonder how many people, if we keep this up for enough years, how many people in the scientific field will have intersected with the Sci Guys podcast at some point?
Very stressful. Very stressful. Whenever scientists review it, I'm like, this could go either way.
But it's mostly gone well.
It has only ever gone well with scientists, which is good. It's better. That's quite nice. It feels
that's
like
a good sign, I reckon.
If you're a scientist and you'd like to leave a 5-star review, head to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. And if you're not a scientist, do it anyway. Just
and
say
if you're
you are
a
one.
Scientist, can't
stop you.
To leave a 4-star or less review, do not.
No,
if you pretend to be a scientist, we'll feel good.
We're not open to peer review, unless it is fantastic peer review.
I love that you're saying here that scientists are our peers. But we have a question for you all as well. So if you're listening with your ears on Apple or Spotify or anywhere else where you could listen to this podcast, head over to youtube.com/SciGuys and answer this question in the comments. What's your favorite dinosaur?
Velociraptor.
Doesn't matter, it's dead.
Oh, chicken? There might not be one day.
No, chicken. I quite like a chicken. Yeah. That's all right.
Chicken.
It's pretty boring. I like me a Triceratops, to be honest.
Oh, doesn't matter. It's dead.
About them.
Don't mind.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just checking.
I'm well aware.
There are dead chickens.
Plenty of dead chickens. In fact, chickens are probably most known for being dead.
Yeah, that's really sad.
But let's start the show regardless. So here is a quote from National Geographic. "Abundant fossils, teeth, bones, trackways, and other hard evidence have revealed that Earth was the domain of the dinosaurs for at least 230 million years. But so far, not a single trace of dinosaur remains has been found in rocks younger than about 66 million years. So, what happened to the dinosaurs?" No?
Too deep. We can't get that far.
No, we can't.
Economic collapse.
Economic collapse.
Oh.
I mean, if their economy was... Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Their economy was plants, and lots of the plants died.
I was going to say, if their economy is the food web, then that thing collapsed real bad. So, let's talk a little bit more about the dinosaurs. So, obviously, the age of the dinosaurs ended, as we mostly know, by a... asteroid impact. Can we all agree on
big
that
rock.
Big rock hit the Earth. Now this was kind of contested for a good while. I think it's still maybe a little bit contested, but as far as I'm aware, I'd feel confident saying that the consensus is that we were hit by an asteroid and that's what killed the dinosaurs, among other things. Obviously, we'll get into the specifics in a little bit. So we know that a massive asteroid slammed into the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. Were you aware of that?
Yeah, there's a big crater.
It is a big crater, but it's hidden underwater, is it not? Or it's no, it's not hidden underwater. It was it was near a lot of water. There's a whole bit at the end of the story make sense. So they've taken rocks from the impact site and they've had a look to see what's going on, and they've found out a lot of cool information just from looking at some rocks, which, go geologists. He got one win. That's...
Yeah. Oh,
I'm joking. It's paleontologists that did this. So not all dinosaurs died that day, but many dinosaurs did, said Sean Gullick, who is a research professor at the University of Texas Institute for Geophysics. So I want to talk to you a little bit about a dinosaur named Tanis. Have you heard of Tanis before?
No.
I love playing tennis. 3 times a week, man.
The tennis club.
So, Tanis is the name of a fossil site where they found a number of very interesting things. So, it's in North Dakota, which is where?
America.
Very good. Yes, it's one of the United States of America.
It is.
But what's really cool about this... Well, take a guess. What do you think is really interesting about the fossils at this site?
I'm guessing they maybe went some way to lending proof to the theory of the asteroid impact.
Oh, boy. We believe that these fossils were actually killed on the day of the impact.
Ooh.
There is fairly decent evidence, it seems. I mean, obviously, I am not a scientist. I'm going based off of the BBC article. To be perfectly honest, that's what I read to get the information on this, along with a couple other places. I heard about it a little while ago, and I thought, wow, this would be a good episode. So that's where this has come from. So supposedly, these remains are very well preserved, but also date back to the day that the asteroid struck. Now, I'll tell you why that is in a second. But what's really cool to me is that there is a dinosaur leg, a fossilized dinosaur leg, which apparently is in such good condition that it has sort of skin on it.
What?
So, yeah. So as far as I'm aware, it seems to be that there is that there is just this really, really well-preserved dinosaur leg. So it's a complete limb with skin, essentially, fossilized.
Would that make it... Oh, right, okay.
No, so it's not like a living...
Yeah, so it is a fossil.
It's a fossil, it's a fossil.
So it's not... There's not skin left now.
It's fossilized skin, is the point.
Okay, yeah, right.
Yeah. So but that's something that is... I mean, this is... I mean, I can show you an image of it. It is utterly incredible.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. So it looks like those things that... Vesuvius, when there's like people made of ash. Yeah.
Well, that would make sense though, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
if a massive asteroid struck, you could have something similar, and also volcanoes going off at the time as well. That's something that was also going on at that time. We'll get to that later on in the episode. So alongside the leg, there were fish and a number of other things as well. Now, what's really interesting about the fish is that you can see that the fish apparently breathed in the debris as it, you know, from the asteroid as it came down. Because obviously, if it hit in Mexico, think about the size of this asteroid.
Yeah.
It hit in Mexico. There is debris in North Dakota.
Yeah.
Not too far from Mexico. But America is a lot bigger than you,
you
think. You know, you could fit a lot of Europe in Texas.
Yeah.
So...
And it's also not the axis of spin, so it's not like the Earth then span towards the cloud. It went north to south, or south to north.
Yeah. Yeah, so like if you look at Mexico and North Dakota, that is a good distance away. It's incredible how far that traveled. And yeah, it wasn't necessarily aided all that much in the northerly direction by the spin. It's just insane. So what they've done is they've looked into this and they've managed to figure out sort of a play-by-play of what could have happened on the day based on all of these fossils, which I just think is so cool. Because you think of fossils as being fairly dead information, right? You look at a fossil and you make a bunch of guesses. I mean, I don't know if this is... So there are probably kids listening to this. I say kids. There are probably like young teenagers listening to this and maybe preteens listening to this. I don't know. How old some of the youngest people listening to this are, but let's assume there are people listening to this who for their entire lives have had feathered dinosaurs as the norm, right?
Oh, has that actually transitioned into like the way dinosaurs are represented in like popular culture?
Not so much the way dinosaurs are represented in popular culture, more the fact that you would have been taught in school that dinosaurs had feathers and we know this. Whereas you remember in school we were taught.
I didn't know they were teaching that now.
Yeah, I mean, they cannot be teaching that dinosaurs don't have feathers.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? As in that, if you're teaching kids about dinosaurs,
they teach kids all sorts of weird stuff in some parts of the world.
Yeah, but my point is that back when we were in school, we had the whole Pluto is a planet, and then Pluto's not a planet, and then maybe it is a planet. Who knows?
Whatever.
And with dinosaurs, with dinosaurs, we went from look at these big scaly lizards to.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, dinosaurs are birds and probably had feathers, but we can't really tell. And then they're like, dinosaurs had feathers.
Yeah,
they had feathers. A bunch of them had feathers. That's just that's their deal. You know, they turned into birds. So
of
course, yeah. And it's really like it's so cool to look at Have you seen a T-Rex done up with all the feathers?
I've not. No.
It doesn't look like what you imagine a T-Rex to look like, or even so a Velociraptor. Velociraptors look like birds.
Really?
When you cover them in I was saying this to someone the other day, and I think they made fun of me for it, but I stand by it. If you cover a dinosaur in feathers, it's incredible how bird-like it looks.
Yeah.
And the person I was talking to said, yeah, well, you cover anything in feathers and it looks like a bird. No. You cover a dinosaur. A sort of a theropod dinosaur. So a theropod dinosaur is the sort of raptor dinosaurs. So the ones that look like a velociraptor. You know, the ones that kind of look like they're leaning forward.
Like a T-Rex.
Like
two
a T-Rex,
legs.
Like chickeny.
Okay, yeah.
Like, so, like chickeny looking ones. Yeah. I mean, I'm not entirely sure if... Yeah, I'm pretty sure T-Rex are theropods. Let me just double check that so I can make sure. Yeah. So T-Rex theropods, I think, also your velociraptor.
Yeah, because if you think of a chicken naked, it's just a little butch T-Rex.
Yeah. Yeah, man, it's wild. Obviously, there's a difference in there, and you could probably figure this one out. Birds tend to have a much larger breastbone for obvious reasons, right? They need to have big breasts so that they can flap their wings and fly. So
be tasty.
That's
the reason.
That's why.
So it's a T-Rex is a gigantic chicken with big boobs.
Kind of. There's also this. I want to actually touch on this as well because No. The T-Rex doesn't have big boobs.
Sorry,
small boobs.
Sorry, the chicken has big boobs.
Yeah, the chicken has big boobs.
Big boob muscle, but yeah, big boobs.
T-Rex is flat chested.
Big pecs.
Yeah.
Big pecs. Yeah. Muscly. So actually, chickens are much more muscly than T-Rexes.
Proportionally
to their size.
But they've got chicken legs, though, don't they? Scrawny little chicken legs.
Yeah. You look at the T-Rex's meaty leg. That's like one of those turkey drummers you got in school.
Yeah.
Oh.
So I actually want to touch on something that I've seen on TikTok, and it's one of those usual things. So if you listen to the bonus episodes over on Patreon, patreon.com/SciGuys, you'll actually find out that we talk about TikToks that I find quite often that wind me up because they're just dead wrong. Now, TikTok seems to have glommed onto this idea that the T-Rex, the fossil, like the sort of skeleton for the T-Rex that we put together, we put the arms on backwards. Because if you look at a T-Rex arms when they're on backwards, it looks a lot like an ostrich. Hmm. And that's it. So T-Rexes were just big ostriches. No, you're dead wrong. Not a single paleontologist has said anything remotely similar to this. You've just looked at some bones that look a little bit similar to your untrained eye and said that's how they should be. It's absolutely not the case. The structure of the bones are different. The way that birds, I mean, we can't even do an episode on this, but I really wish we could. I implore everyone to look into bird bones. Or just bones in evolution in general, because those are fascinating to me. So you've obviously got, you've got the bones of your arm, which then turn into sort of wrist bones, and then you've got your hand bones, and then your finger bones.
Oh yeah, and the finger bones are the wings in birds.
Pretty much every single animal that is sort of remotely closely related has the same arm plan that we do. Like, I mean, you look at horses, you look at birds. So basically all mammals and birds have that. Reptiles can go a bit different, but birds and mammals have the same arm plan. They have the same bloody bone that they've evolved from, more or less. And, like, it's so cool to see.
But is that right? What I've heard, like, in the wing of, like, a chicken, say, what we consider to be our fingers are like super long and they make up the entire wing. Like they make up the structure of the wing. And then what we consider our forearm and like arm are like super short.
Yeah. So, okay. I'm just looking at a diagram here and we could chuck this diagram up. So essentially what we're looking at here is you've obviously got your humerus, which is your big long, the sort of long arm bone, you know, not your forearm, your
upper arm,
and then your forearm bones are your radius and ulna, which I hate because they cross over and that's disgusting. Wrong.
Ooh, yeah,
yes. Yeah. So you've got two bones in your forearm.
Oh, you've ruined arms for me.
I genuinely found that out when I was 24 and I hated it. I've hated it from the minute that someone, because it is incredibly irritating. They shouldn't be crossing over. Ugh. They should stay straight.
I'm so aware of this now.
So you've got your radius and your ulna, and then you've got your carpals, which is the sort of the wristy handy bones, and then you've got your metacarpals, which are these sort of these other bones sort of in your hands, and then you've got your phalanges, which are your finger bones, as far as I'm aware. This might be a little bit off, but I'm pretty sure that's how it works. You've got your carpals, metacarpals, phalanges. So wristy bones, handy bones, finky bones.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, with a bird... Now, let's talk about bats, because this diagram has bats on it as well, and that's a really interesting way to consider it. So bats, obviously, convergent evolution, they also evolved wings in the same way. Not in the same way that birds did. In a similar way to how birds evolved wings.
But separately obviously, to birds.
Separately to birds. Yeah, right. But also, they clearly had had to adapt... what like a mammalian hand essentially, right? So what bats do is they this is a bat wing is like this, right?
What are
you
doing? This for is, audio listeners.
I'll okay. explain. A bat wing is like this. So you've got your arm sort of bent and your fingers splayed out, and the wings of the bat are just fingers with a whole bunch of skin
webbing
in between. A very webbed fingers. And then the pinky finger, the skin of the pinky finger then attaches to sort of the foot. And you know what I mean? And that's how you get a bat wing. And they've got the little thumb. You've got a little thumb at the top of the bat wing, which is like the little sort of claw, the grabby claw. But their fingers are just the wings, which is incredible to me. Whereas birds are kind of different. So they've got the radius. They've got, you know, they've obviously got the humerus and then the radius and the ulna.
Yeah.
And then they've got the carpal, so the sort of wristy bones, and then the metacarpal, so the sort of hand bones are quite elongated, right? And then they've only got, I think, three phalanges, it looks like, so three fingers. So it's easier to lose features than it is to gain them.
Yeah.
You know, for example, whales can lose their back legs, and I think still have the bones for them somewhere buried in their body. And lose their fingers, despite the fact that the bones for them are still buried in their bloody fins. Stupid. So stupid. I love it so much. Evolution is dumb and I love it.
If ever you wanted evidence that intelligent design probably wasn't the case, just look at all the stupid things evolution has done.
Man.
There's literally a nerve that goes like down from your head down to like the middle of your stomach and then back up to your voice box or something. Like
sure. That. Intelligent design is if that would be, I honestly think, if like a toddler were to design thing, like, okay, it's more complex than a toddler could design. But if God was a toddler, that would be intelligent design.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, you're like, oh, well, I've put this down. Oh,
a toddler with no undo button.
Yeah, no undo button. That's it. It's drawing in pen. You're like, oh, man, wouldn't it be cool if I drew this? I gave it legs, but legs are bad for where it lives. I guess I'll just kind of cover the legs.
Join the legs
body.
Up.
okay, sure. So birds... So with birds, obviously, their arms are pretty similar up until the sort of wrist bones. And then you've got the sort of wristy, handy bones that are kind of similar-ish to ours. And then it's the metacarpals. So that would be, I think, in our hands. Do you know how you can kind of feel the bones in your hand?
Extra like fingers. Separate bones.
Your fingers so extend right down.
Yeah.
It feels kind of to your wrist. Which, again,
freaky.
Weird. It feels like if you were to split your fingers down, you could just have super extra long fingers.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that part of birds is what's modified, right? That part of birds is they've got two carpals, metacarpals, it looks like, which are sort of like elongated and kind of coming together, kind of like the radius and ulna. And then they've got three phalanges, which are sort of, one is jutting off the top, kind of like how the bat phalange juts off the top.
No,
yes, the bat finger juts off the top. And then they've got kind of two other fingers still inside the wing that are just kind of like this in a sort of like peace sign shape pointing downwards. And so bird wings, the way that they're depicted in media are basically not how bird wings actually look. I mean, when you look at a bird wing when it's like plucked, it just looks like two pointy sort of like, it looks like two sort of pointy stabby things.
Yeah.
Which I've seen on some dinosaurs. Looks very cool. And you can kind of understand how something like a T-Rex or a Velociraptor could have evolved into something more like a chicken. Or something along that line, or along those lines, say, or something like an ostrich, or anything else. You know, you could see how the sort of progression there. They just kind of lose bones, extend some of them, move to different places. It's really, really bloody interesting. So that's kind of the connection between dinosaurs and birds, because birds literally are just dinosaurs. So this this fossil site, they found, as I said, they found that leg, some fish, but they've also found a turtle. And I'll just read this out directly from the BBC website, actually. It says, we see a fossil turtle that was skewered at by a wooden stake, the remains of small mammals and the burrows they made, skin from a horned triceratops, the embryo of a flying pterosaur inside its egg, and what appears to be a fragment of from the asteroid impactor itself. And it's just, it's so bloody cool. So the leads... the graduate student who's leading the dig at this site, Robert De Palma, has said, he's from the University of Manchester in the UK. He said, we've got so many details with this site that tell us what happened moment by moment. It's almost like watching it play out in the movies. You look at the rock column, you look at the fossils there, and it brings you back to that day. This is what's incredible to me about archaeology, is that, as I said, it seems like this dead thing, but you look at fossils, you could look at the fossil records and you could track how species have evolved over time, or you could look at fossils, you could date them, you could see what elements are present in certain areas. I mean, and we'll get to that in a bit, you could look at what elements are present in certain areas and build up a picture of what's happened. The way that we can reconstruct events is incredible to me. It's just absolutely baffling.
And I suppose another thing that would lend credibility to the idea of a massive impact is if you find elements in one area that don't belong there and aren't normally there in the in the record.
Hold on to that thought.
Okay, cool.
So that is sort of this this North Dakota site. It's about I think 3,000 kilometers away from the impact site.
Wow.
Which is, I mean, you can see where the rotation of the Earth, I think, would have contributed to some of that, but a lot of that is northerly direction, you know. Yeah. A lot of it is northerly direction, and it's just baffling, absolutely baffling. So there are sort of, as it says here, the sturgeon and paddlefish in this fossil tangle are key. They have small particles stuck in their gills. These are the spherules of molten rock kicked out from the impact that then fell back across the planet. The fish would have breathed in the particles as they entered the river. So they've basically used sort of radiometric dating and chemical analysis to figure out that the particles that they've recovered are not from Earth, essentially. There's an extraterrestrial origin. So, boom, an asteroid must have hit, or something must have come down to Earth to mean it, like, otherwise we wouldn't find these chemicals in those places, in trees and in fish and whatnot. It's so interesting. So they've looked into all of this. Is like just, this is chemistry, this is geology, geography, paleontology, all of these sort of different disciplines coming together to help us build this picture of what it actually looks like. So the BBC is actually making a TV show. I think they've been at it since maybe, gosh, 2019. I think that was, or 2019 was roughly when the stuff from this dig site started coming out to the public. So about 3 years ago, and the BBC have been working on a TV show, I think, with David Attenborough.
Is that the one that's out? So this is the one that, like, starts off as an animation. It starts off as like an animation with a bunch of T-Rexes, and then it travels over to a dig site. And the dig site is so secret that they're not allowed to say where it is.
Oh, amazing. So they've been filming there for years, the BBC, which is really quite fantastic. They've brought in a lot of experts to get information on this, which is really interesting, because usually, obviously, these kind of breakthroughs would be published in papers, and the BBC is kind of, you know, giving it to the people.
Wow.
Which I think is forefront. Really interesting.
Yeah.
Ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
It sure is.
It's the ad bell.
Well, the ad gods have asked us to promote our Patreon on this episode.
Hell yes!
Thanks to our patrons over at patreon.com/SciGuys, you get SciGuys every single week. But if you become a patron, you can get a whole host of other things. What can they get if they join our Patreon?
An extra episode a month.
You can get access to our super secret Patreon podcast, After Dark. Just because SciGuys has ended doesn't mean the conversation has.
That's right, and you can also vote on episode topics, submit episode topics for the vote, and some patrons can just get rid of democracy altogether and tell us exactly what episode they want us to make. You get bonus clips, behind the scenes stuff, lots of cool stuff over on our Patreon. You should definitely go and check it out right now. Patreon.com/SciGuys.
Don't miss it.
I agree.
Let's start the show again. So essentially they've got so many cool things. So I'm just going to read out some quotes from Paul Barrett, who is a sort of expert in plant-eating dinosaurs. Ornithischian. He's an expert in ornithischian dinosaurs.
That means vegan dinosaurs.
He says, it's a Thescelosaurus. Why am I reading these out for the first time now? It's from a group that we didn't have any previous record of what its skin looked like. So weird. And it shows very conclusively that these animals were very scaly like lizards. They weren't feathered like their meat-eating contemporaries. This looks like an animal whose leg had simply been ripped off really quickly. There's no evidence of leg of disease. There are no obvious pathologies. There's no trace of the leg being scavenged, such as bite marks or bits of it that are missing. So the best idea that we have is that this is an animal that died more or less instantaneously. Bloody interesting.
On that, yes. You said earlier that there was a turtle that was impaled by a stake of wood.
Yes.
How on earth did that happen in prehistoric times?
I don't know. I mean, there's wood about, there's turtles about. A dinosaur could stab
yeah,
a turtle.
But neither of those things are moving very fast.
Yeah, but an explosion.
Oh, like wood falling from the sky or flying across.
Yeah, yeah. One would assume. Yeah.
What a way to die.
I feel like
that's like got to be one of the first animals to be like impaled on something. Because like we didn't have, like people weren't around making spears yet.
I feel like it's quite easy for animals to be impaled. I mean, depends on.
Yeah, what would you get impaled on? Other than like a falling tree?
I would say other animals.
Well, other animals with their things. Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Are there many animals with spiky rhino horns? Yeah, okay, fine.
Triceratops.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got okay. three, haven't I?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well.
Wow.
Triple threat.
Yeah.
So, this is just, this is really interesting. There are obviously some scientists that are more skeptical about this. I don't want to make it out as though this is 100% set in stone. Set in stone. I don't want to make out as though this is absolutely set in stone, but there is quite good evidence, and some scientists are quite excited about this. I just want to share this with you. So take it with a grain of salt. Mm. I'm not an expert. You shouldn't be trusting me for, being absolutely 100% correct on the things that scientists... You know, I can't make the decision on whether it's correct or not. Listen to scientists. I'm just telling you what I've read from them. So, as I've said, there are some people who are maybe less than convinced about it. So, for example, this is from Professor Steve Brusatti from the University of Edinburgh. He has said that it's possible, for example, this is just from the BBC, that animals that had died before the impact were exhumed by the violence on the day and then reinterred in a way that made their deaths appear concurrent. So, what he's saying is these animals died, and just the impact on the day could have brought them out again from where they were sort of being entombed. Mm. And given, like, and basically put all of this sort of space junk in them and then sort of re-entombed them so that it appears that it all happened at once, which isn't terribly sort of improbable. You know? So, understandably, not everyone is absolutely convinced on this. I'm not saying that you absolutely should be convinced on this, but it is quite interesting. So I'll tell you a little bit of something else. So they also had the pterosaur egg, the sort of pterosaur embryo in the egg. So what they've done is they've used x-rays to figure out what the sort of chemistry and the properties of the eggshell would be. It doesn't matter specifically the sort of process that you used. They said it was likely leathery rather than hard, which may indicate that the pterosaur mother buried the egg in sand or sediment like a turtle, which is really bloody cool.
Aww.
That is kind of the tanistic site. And I want to move on to more about sort of what actually happened. So do you know who it was that sort of proposed that an asteroid was the cause of the death of the dinosaurs?
I do not.
Oh, I don't know.
So it's the Alvarez hypothesis. So in 1980, there was a Nobel Prize winning physicist, Louis Walter Alvarez, and he had a son who was a geologist, Walter Alvarez. They published their theory of sort of a large asteroid hitting the Earth and that being the cause for the dinosaurs dying. Now, Luke, you pointed out something that would be quite key evidence in showing that an asteroid may have hit.
Well, if stuff had moved around the Earth and been deposited on the ground in sort of the geological record that doesn't appear naturally in other like if there's a certain type of rock in one area and it turns up 1,000 miles away, that's pretty good evidence that unless something's probably not moved at 1,000 miles, so it's been thrown 1,000 miles.
So the key thing here, the key metal we're looking at here is iridium. And iridium, which if you've seen the Avengers, it's a very good stabilizing agent if you want to open a space portal.
Is it actually?
Or
No.
No.
Does it? No. I mean, sorry.
I mean, if the space
stone. I started saying that sentence before you finished your sentence.
Yeah.
Like, is this a real thing about Iridium or no? Oh wait, no, space portals. Maybe we'll see.
We'll see.
More research is needed.
Hey, as soon as we get our hands on that bloody space stone, we'll see. Yeah. We'll see. So, Iridium is rare in Earth's crust, but there is just a ton of Iridium, relatively speaking, where the impact site is. So,
that's,
as I said,
very convenient.
The impact site was off the coast of Mexico, and it actually is underwater. I've just double checked again. It is underwater. The impact site now,
present day. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Now it's just it's there's a big crater underwater, which is, I guess, one of the reasons that we didn't necessarily find it immediately. So there is
not being aquatic animals. Yes,
yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, not going to be diving down the Gulf of Mexico. We're usually just spilling oil over there, aren't we? That's our thing. Spill
which
oil.
Which will make it even harder to see the bottom.
Exactly. But it's giving the dinosaurs their revenge, isn't it?
Putting the dinosaurs back in the impact site.
No, look, okay. Someone's going to say in the comments that
oil
isn't dinosaurs. It's more likely plants and blah, blah, blah. I know.
It'll be a tiny bit dinosaurs, maybe.
There is a chance that there is at least one single tiny bit of dinosaur in there.
Just like there's a bit of water that went through Hitler in every glass of water.
I don't think that's
true.
In every glass of
in
water?
In every glass of water, there'll be a little tiny... one particle of that water will have gone through Hitler.
That...
Statistically.
That seems unlikely.
Well, please. More research is needed.
No, I understand the concept that's being proposed.
How much water was he drinking?
A normal amount of water.
One would assume. But I would say
it was quite heated, so maybe a bit more than average.
My point is that I understand the concept that you know, water is, it's constant essentially, that it's just recycled over and over and over. It still is hard for me to think that a man who spent most of his time in Austria and then Germany would have, like, the water would have traveled so far across the world that everyone in every glass is drinking a little bit of that. That seems unlikely.
Wow.
So as I was saying, Iridium is the main sort of thing we're looking at here. It's rare in Earth's crust, but there's lots of it in meteorites, and a big rock fell from the sky, okay? A big hunk of just stuff fell from the sky, made a big old crater, left a bunch of its Iridium sitting about, and we thought, hey, there must have been an asteroid that killed off these dinos. So... it's actually really, just really interesting, as I said. So I might be mentioning the KPG boundary, which is the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary.
Oh, we know.
Yeah.
No.
Cretaceous is spelled with a C, by the way. I don't know why.
I've been spelling it wrong my whole life.
So the Cretaceous, you've written the word Cretaceous before, I'm sure.
I don't think I've written it.
Okay. He said it then.
Maybe said it.
So the Cretaceous Paleogene, it's just sort of the time period, I believe. Yeah, the sort of, it's the layer, goodness me, it's a layer of the Earth, I believe, that sort of indicates that time period.
Yes, yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes, like the layer of the cake from that time. And you're adding more layers on top of the cake.
Yes, thank you. With every,
and then the lower the layer, the longer the time.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
And the bottom of the cake turns to oil.
What?
The bottom of the
cake does maybe turn to oil. I don't know how that works, actually, so maybe not.
And you get a straw and you suck it up.
And you suck it up.
We can discuss.
And then you destroy the thing that hosts your life.
We can discuss the formation of natural gas and oil and coal another day.
Fantastic.
Pressure, time, and organic material, basically. Deary me. So... they found, as I said, they found a bunch of fossils in that sort of layer of the Earth, right? The KPG boundary. And that's the sort of Tanis, that's the Tanis site that we're talking about. That's where they were digging. So they've found so much stuff, like in those layers, so many fossils, loads of tiny bits of glass called tektites, I'll say, which are a little, apparently little blobs of melted rock kicked up by the impact that solidified in the atmosphere and then rained down over Earth.
I find this fascinating. I was literally doing some research about this on a story I'm doing about the moon, and about how, like, the heat of impacts creates glass.
Yeah.
And you never think about that, because you never think about the fact that glass, obviously you know that glass is just like sand.
It's hot sand.
Hot sand. But it doesn't feel like it is because because glass is so perfect and clear, and sand is not
clear. You can't
see
through, through sand. No. Yeah.
And then there's volcanic glass, which is just sharp and hard and ouchy and black usually as well. That stuff is scary, right?
I've not come across any, but you've if I did, I would be quaking.
Oh, no. Volcanic glass is cool, but also it's like if you sort of shatter that thing, it's sharp and hard and it hurts. It's something that I find very cool, but I'm also very cautious of. But glass in general, it just feels like it shouldn't come from sand.
Nah, it feels like it shouldn't exist without people.
Right?
It just shouldn't.
It shouldn't.
It does, but it shouldn't.
It shouldn't. And also, again, it comes from sand? No. Sand is essentially a powder of hard, not see-through stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Glass is a pane of see-through stuff.
Solid pane of see-through.
Yeah, glass feels like the kind of stuff you'd make in Minecraft when you, like, do some crafting. And it doesn't feel like the Earth should be able to do crafting without you there.
Obviously, the glass that we're talking about isn't
tiny little
just
bits
glass
of
that we'd normally think of. It's a bit different. But still, you just take rocks and make them see-through, and then you put it on your... Weird. Our houses are made of rocks.
Yes.
Just, like, a lot... Just mostly rocks.
They're very well-built rocks, but yes, they're mainly rocks. Like, we've got good at using rocks, but it's still rocks.
That is so ridiculous.
We're just living a big old game of Minecraft, and we're pretending that we're not.
We can put electricity through the rocks.
Yeah.
We figure out a way.
That's very true. Yeah. I mean, you take... Well, what we could also do is take rocks and then take parts out of the rocks and then make wires with the parts we've taken out of the rock.
And then you pass a current through those wires and then encase them in more rock, and then you've got a bulb.
Yeah.
So stupid. So, moving back, let's do a little sort of play-by-play of what happened. Maybe not exactly a play-by-play. I don't have that much detail. But just to give you an idea of what happened. So, 425 feet of material started to accumulate where the asteroid hit. And apparently, it's been estimated up to 10 billion World War II era atomic bombs is the power of that strike.
That'd do it.
Which makes sense. I mean, when you start hearing about the stuff that happened, it's honestly unbelievable. So the asteroid came down. Bear in mind, this asteroid was huge. And what happened was a lot of water then just rushed into this crater that was made. We gotta remember that the asteroid hits, there is an incredible amount of power. You know, like nuclear bomb levels, multiple nuclear bomb levels. So, it hits and vaporizes just so much. Like, things are just vaporized. Mm. And there's a massive crater, obviously, and it's next to a bunch of water. So all of this stuff that has been shoved out of the way and burnt up has been shoved into sort of the water, and the water sort of rushes then back in to fill the sort of crater, which sounds maybe okay. That's a tsunami, my friends.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Very bad. It's very bad.
I hope there weren't anything living in that water.
Oh, it's not. I wouldn't say not necessarily quite a tsunami, but that's the vibe you got to think about. I mean, I feel comfortable describing that as a tsunami, I would say. Like, that water is not coming back in slowly. Okay, yeah. That stuff is rushing back in. So, the water has come rushing back in. There is charcoal in the deposits that they found, which indicates that trees and other plants were just lit on fire. But luckily, they didn't burn for very long.
Oh. They disintegrated or something.
No,
luckily.
No, the tsunami came.
Put them out.
Fireman Sam.
You don't have to worry about burning if there's a tsunami. If you're on fire, a tsunami is coming, you're all good.
Life finds a way.
Bear in mind, this will be a while away from the actual direct impact site, because if you're on the direct impact site, vaporized, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, no, that's burning in the tsunami would be the least of your worries. So the tsunami wave comes and it hits. It pulls all of the burnt up trees and whatnot that have been blasted outward back into the crater. So apparently some researchers have said this, that the fires that were started could have gone thousands of miles across. And the tsunami waves, bear in mind, the impact site was around Mexico.
Yeah.
Illinois is apparently where the tsunami waves could have reached. Illinois.
That's quite high up the US, isn't
Chicago it? Chicago is in Illinois.
Oh my god, it's at the top of the US.
It's at the top of the US. These are big tsunami waves. This is what some scientists have said. We don't know, of course. Okay. Then apparently, what's also really interesting as well is that if you escaped the initial blast, so I really like when we've compared this to nuclear bombs, and it's interesting to me because it feels very similar in the way that the impact sort of in the way that the sort of deaths occurred.
Yeah,
like, in that you think of a bomb dropping and you're like, oh, bomb drops, and then if you didn't die when the bomb drops, you're fine.
Yeah.
Blast wave.
You got the bomb dropping. The blast wave, if you're not vaporized, then with the nuclear one, there's fallout. And then there's the dust cloud, which blocks up. There's so many problems.
Then you starve.
Luckily, in this case, it wasn't a nuclear sort of explosion. It wasn't a nuclear impact. So that's useful for these, I guess, extinct dinosaurs.
But everything else is similar. It's just there's no nuclear stuff, but everything else is it's a vast amount of energy released in a small space quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, the only difference between this and what we would see from most nuclear sort of, I say the only difference, the main difference from this and what we'd see from most sort of nuclear bombs is that there is not any fallout, which essentially means that if you manage to survive the initial impact and then all of the horrible environmental effects that happen afterwards, you're not going to die of radiation sickness. So
great.
It's generally fine.
Fantastic.
But when we talk about the reason I'm bringing up atom bombs essentially here is because it is so similar in it. That's the closest thing that I think we can think of in terms of power to this.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's the closest that we can get to actually considering it.
Out of interest, you mentioned earlier, you said this is about 10 World War II era atom bombs.
It says 10 billion World War II atom bombs.
Okay, and there's the billion.
Yeah, 10 billion.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask what's a modern day, but it would still be billions times more. So it doesn't really compare. Wow, we're really puny. The tiniest thing, the most powerful thing we've ever made is like a tiny little speck compared to this.
This is why Ultron's plan from Age of Ultron was actually genius. I'm not joking. You take a city and you drop it from orbit on the Earth.
You pick it up and you drop it.
You are killing so many people.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need nukes to do that. You just drop a city.
You just lift an entire city up.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. But, like, he's an AI robot man made of indestructible metal. I think...
My mistake.
Yeah, whose indestructible robot son turned against him. I think it's perfectly fine that he lifts a city up and drops it.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
Especially my apologies.
He's fighting against the bloody god of thunder, and you got an issue with him lifting up
a
city.
You're right.
So, as I was saying, the tsunami waves could have reached as far as Illinois, and the rock samples told them something pretty interesting, which was that apparently, if you were a dinosaur and you survived that initial blast, lucky you, there was a bunch of sulfur that was just vaporized. So, around the crater, there are a lot of rocks that have got a lot of sulfur in. Lots of rocks with lots of sulfur. In the crater, not much sulfur at all. What's going on there? Sulfur vaporized, went up into the atmosphere, blocked the sun.
Nice.
So the sulfur would have been vaporized, gone to the atmosphere, as I said, and that gas in the atmosphere would have just sort of would have had basically the opposite of a greenhouse effect. It would have just reflected the sunlight back into space, which meant that just immediately there was this global cooling effect. Remember when that bloody what's it called, that Icelandic volcano went off? It's Icelandic, I believe, the one that's impossible to pronounce. It went off and we weren't able to fly planes for ages. There was soot all like spreading across the world. Things were like cooling a little bit. Remember that? Imagine that, but just everywhere
for a very long time.
Long time.
And also you don't know what's going on because you're a little dinosaur.
A dinosaur or a little mammal or a little fishy.
Little shrew.
And you're just like, what's going on? You come out your burrow and you're like,
Oh no.
Well, actually, if you're a mammal, you're like, haha, I'm glad I evolved me some fur because I don't need to worry too much about the changes in temperature. I'm glad that survival is not dependent on the temperature that my eggs are kept at because I keep my eggs inside me. No, so,
and I have warm blood.
I actually don't know if mammals had evolved. I don't know if mammals at that point had evolved out of laying eggs. I'm not actually sure. I don't know. The timelines, there's so much to know on all of this that because I don't specialize in that, I just find it interesting. There are so many blind spots for me in that regard. So I don't know where mammals were at their point of evolution. So you know, that sort of suit that was in the atmosphere, what do you think that that did beyond just making it colder?
Killed all the plants.
Why would it have killed all the plants?
They want to drink the sun, but they can't get any. There's a big mirror in the sky.
Well, lucky for us, right? Okay, we don't eat the sun. So we were fine, right?
No,
all the other animals were fine?
We either eat the plants or we eat the things that eat the plants.
Oh, so you're saying that because the plants died, everything else died?
I am suggesting that was mostly true.
Goodness me. Yeah. Yeah, so the plants then died out because of the lack of sunlight, which meant that messed up the food web, because you've got herbivores that then can't have the plants and they're dying out. And then you've got your predators who don't have herbivores to eat, and so they're dying out. And then the larger predators are dying out even worse because they got nothing going on for them. And if you are not, say, a creature that has a very varied diet, you're screwed.
You cannot
keep up. So it's really like a chain reaction. It's just the entire ecosystem just collapsed, just because you take out that bit of the foundation, the plants, boom, it's just it just collapses. There was nothing that anything could do, because plants are really just that foundation of food webs, because they take energy from just space.
Yeah.
And make it so that everything else can use that energy. So apparently, we don't know specifics on what exactly the mechanism was that killed a lot of different things, and we don't know how long all of this sort of stuff necessarily lasted, but we do, we're pretty certain that it was an asteroid that hit, right? That's, we're pretty certain that a rock hit from space.
Yeah.
You know? So lots and lots of stuff died out. You've got ammonites, microscopic plankton, large marine reptiles, a bunch of dinosaurs, non-avian dinosaurs, essentially. You know, crocodiles managed to survive, some mammals managed to survive, avian dinosaurs managed to survive, and, you know, a few other things are still about today. But, dearie me, this was a mass extinction event. Mm. So, it's interesting, because let's talk about what could have happened, you know, had the dinosaurs actually survived, you know? Because if you think about this, if it wasn't for this mass extinction event, what would you expect today to look like?
Well, presumably some slowly evolving towards higher intelligent dinosaurs.
Well, actually, interesting. Well, I mean, we've kind of got that. Birds are, like, crows are fairly intelligent. So
but like dinosaurs in business suits.
So what's going what to work. Was actually
actual
going on?
Wall Street.
There was actually some a global climate change effect going on already.
Right.
Because obviously there are natural climate changes. No, this one is not a natural climate change. It's caused by human
oh, no.
interaction with the planet. Don't
do it.
Don't do it.
Don't you do it.
So we're going back to the dinosaur times and talking about this natural climate change, not the current one, which isn't natural. We're going back to then and talking about the natural climate change that was happening. So that was already would already have spelled a bit of an issue for the animals and plants living at the time, because things were changing already. So climate change can wipe out a lot of life. So the avian dinosaurs were in a good niche, essentially. They were actually all right, and they probably would have survived anyway. I'm not saying that things would have looked exactly the same as today. So coming from an expert here, apparently we probably would have seen a lot more sort of non-bird like dinosaurs, apparently, if that hadn't happened. But we probably would have seen the mammals sort of rise regardless, and avian dinosaurs continue to develop in similar ways, because there was already a climate change going on. This was just a big event that caused, I mean, a massive change in the environment of the Earth, which, you know, obviously just killed off a lot of things all at once, but it did, it sped up some things that were going on already. That's not to say it would have been exactly the same. It would have been quite different, but I don't want to give the impression that the dinosaurs were all doing just hunky-dory, and then an asteroid hits, and then suddenly it's not. There were already things going on. So a part of that is that some people were saying sort of that, oh, it's not an asteroid, it was volcanoes. So the idea is that there was changes in temperature before the impact happened about 66 million years ago, and volcanic activity was becoming pretty frequent, and so that was changing a lot of things, and that could have caused some extinctions, and that makes sense, but it more thought of that it could be both, right? So I think the idea is that the asteroid hits, and that had a massive impact. And as I said, there was already this period of climate change, which was heavily sort of spurred on by volcanic activity. Obviously, volcanic activity can change the climate in what ways? Or what main way? We've spoken about it already.
Well, ash
being in the sky is a big one that ash being in the sky and spewing just gases into the atmosphere that changed the sort of quality and how much heat it retains. So those are sort of long-term changes caused by volcanic activity, and the asteroid would have been that big just smash. I've taken out a bunch of stuff, but the volcanoes were doing a lot of work anyway. So what survived the impact? What survived that mass extinction?
Well, either alligators or crocodiles, or maybe both.
Probably both, I believe.
Yeah. Chickens?
No.
Or chickens came from something.
Like raptors and
theropods.
Stuff.
Theropods. Or avian dinosaurs, rather.
And a bunch of stuff under the sea.
So, yeah. I mean,
and small things, I think.
Smaller things were better at surviving because bigger things need more energy, generally. And so that was harder to find, especially if you had to find it from a bunch of smaller things. And obviously, flowering plants were just super dominant after the dinosaurs' extinction. I'm not entirely sure why, but flowering plants, as in plants that have flowers, this is interesting. People think of flowering plants as that's just plants.
Mm.
Nah. Flowering plants just had this massive boom after that. Apparently all land animals weighing over 25 kilograms died.
That's all of us,
really?
Al.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But, you know, mammals were pretty solid because they've got fur and they're sort of, they can regulate their body temperature. They're not super dependent on the external temperatures for that. So it's actually really interesting. So here's a quote from an expert on this. He says, "What we're left with are basically the seeds of what we have today. Many of the major animal groups that are alive today were in place before the asteroid impact, and they all suffered some level of extinction, but the lines that led to modern animals got through. All of the non-bird dinosaurs died out, but dinosaurs survived as birds. Some types of bird did go extinct, but the lineages that led to modern birds survived." So, obviously, after this, you had just a lot of smaller animals, which is really interesting. You know, just a world of slightly smaller animals. And there were very big birds that survived that were, I think, both predatory and herbivorous. And they died out pretty quickly, just because it's hard to maintain that level of body mass when there's not that much food. And 15 million years after the sort of non-bird dinosaurs went extinct, This is something called the Oligocene Epoch, I think. Oligocene Epoch, that's when you started to get the big mammals, like rhino-sized mammals, sort of starting to appear. And before that, for 15 million years, it was mostly small mammals, small sort of bird-like creatures, or avian dinosaurs, and and obviously some kinds of flowering plants and whatnot, and some sea creatures, you know. But you had your mosasaurs die out. I think you had your plesiosaurs. I think the plesiosaurs died out around about there. But you had a lot of sea creatures. I'm not so sure about the megalodon when that went extinct, but I'm not sure. But you had a lot of sea creatures that just went out as well, because you think that the sea is separate from the sort of land and all of that, but bear in mind that there are there are plankton in the water that need to get light from the sky. If there's less light from the sky, the plankton in the water can't get that. If there's no plankton in the water, then you can't have the smaller animals that feed on, you can't have the zooplankton that feed on the sort of, what's the word for it? Oh, I can't remember the word. You can't have the zooplankton that feed on the other plankton. So you can't then have the stuff that feed on the zooplankton and the other plankton eating that. And then you can't have the slightly bigger things eating that, which means that you don't have the mosasaurs and whatnot eating their big prey, and you're just screwed.
What about all of the bugs? Because there are these flowering plants. Presumably there's something pollinating these flowering plants, or the flowers wouldn't have stuck around.
Bugs did okay. I think the bugs are ancient. Bugs are quite old.
Yeah.
I think the main issue for bugs, now I don't know the timing of this, so I may be wrong, but I'm going to draw from what I've heard elsewhere. I think one of the big issues for bugs is oxygen. Bugs can be basically whatever size if there's a high enough oxygen density, because they're very weird in the way that they're, and we're talking colloquial bugs here, not scientific bugs, insects generally, right? They operate in that they've got kind of essentially these tubes going into them, rather than sort of breathing through lungs, they just have tubes that go into parts of their body. And if there's not high enough oxygen density, then the oxygen can't penetrate deep enough for them to be bigger. So the higher the oxygen density, the bigger bugs can be. Bugs, I think, generally went fine. You know, bugs are bugs. They're bloody hardy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think flowering plants. I don't know when flowering plants and bugs started to use each other in the way that they use each other now for pollination and food. Mm. I'm not sure. I mean, I'll look into that. This is the stuff that I find incredibly interesting, but there's so much.
Yes.
So much.
There sure is.
I mean, I would recommend PBS Eons. Really great for all of this sort of stuff. Really, really good. Kurtzgesagt's got a few good things on it as well. But PBS Eons is just mad solid for just good little sort of tidbits and bite-sized pieces about this. So that's what survived, I guess. But why don't we talk about briefly how, or why, rather, the birds survived. So why do you reckon the birds survived?
Oh, because they can move around.
Really? That's interesting. That's not a bad idea.
They can move somewhere warm, and they can move, like, they're much quicker.
Right.
So it's not actually flight, that sort of thing that gave them the advantage. Apparently it's food, which I kind of alluded to earlier. So if these birds were sort of moving towards toothless beaks and feathers and all of that sort of stuff, right? And a part of this sort of evolutionary move was a more varied diet. And as I was saying earlier, if you have a more varied diet, then you are more likely to survive an event like this because so for example, if an anteater were to, if there was an extinction event of ants, the anteater would be screwed. Obviously, yeah. Ants do so much for so many different parts of our food web, like it would be catastrophic if ants were to disappear. But the anteater is out immediately, just out.
Yeah.
Other animals that eat ants but also eat other things could be fine. They could rely more heavily on another food source, but then that would dwindle. But then hopefully they would fill a niche of the ants. Food webs are complicated. Food webs are one of those things where you think, I take this out, and it will... No. Any calculation or estimation you make on a food web is wrong.
Yeah.
I can promise you that.
It's like a Jenga tower. You just all fall down.
It's incredibly complex. So they changed their sort of skull shape and lost their teeth, and the tissues on their faces sort of changed as they started to eat more fruits and seeds and other plants. And I think they were also sort of having insects and other small things. You know, birds have that diet today. But because they were moving towards more fruits and seeds and other plant foods, they were probably more able to survive that mass extinction. Because while a bunch of plants did die out, some survived, and if you're able to eat those, that's honestly probably a better source of energy rather than having to rely on it's another step in the process, right? So if you're a fox, you eat, say, a rabbit, right? Now a rabbit can just eat whatever is growing in the ground. A fox has to make sure that there is enough food to sustain the rabbits so that there are enough rabbits to sustain the fox, right? Yeah. So there's just that extra step, which makes it that slight bit harder, potentially. So, yeah, I mean, these, apparently, so according to Ryan Felice, he is an anatomist at UCL, very, very smart person, clearly. He has said all the things that make birds birds were already in place well before the mass extinction. So when the extinction hit, obviously birds have been developing all of these different sort of adaptations for a while, and it clearly gave them that edge that let them survive. So not necessarily flight, but probably more just the versatility of birds. Because, you know, I mean, if you think about birds, they can be quite versatile in their diets and in their sort of niches. I mean, think of Darwin's finches, right? That's like the sort of quintessential idea of different birds developing different beaks for different niches. But also, you've got some birds that are highly specialized and other birds that can be slightly more varied. I mean, you could see the same across the animal kingdom, but birds are quite good, you know, in that respect, because they've got their feathers for their warmth, they can fly and move around to different places, as you said, Luke, and they can eat nuts, seeds, insects, bunch of different things. And so it just gave them that edge that made them sort of essentially just manage to survive longer than the non-avian dinosaurs. I think it says here, particularly when sort of animals started to die out, other animals started to die out a lot, beaked birds were able to eat seeds and a lot more efficiently than other animals, and so that basically let them last until the vegetation started coming back. And obviously beaks aren't just the only thing that gave them the edge. There are so many reasons. This is, if you try to put it down to one thing, you're just getting it wrong. It's so complex.
Yeah.
But that is roughly why the birds may have survived, because they have beaks and they're able to digest and break down seeds, which, you know, if you think about it, we think about pumpkin seeds and other kinds of seeds like that. But a lot of seeds don't want you to eat. I mean, all seeds don't want you to eat them, basically. Right? You know, seeds don't want to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And so they're tough on the outside, and we eat the ones that are easy to eat, but there are other seeds that are harder to eat, and these birds were clearly able to get into them,
yeah,
which gave them that edge. Mammals obviously had the edge of being warm-blooded and not so reliant on the external temperature as maybe other sort of creatures at the time were. Also, they could burrow and were smaller as well, which was a big help. So they survived, birds survived, crocodiles are just good at what they do. Mm-hmm. Those guys just, they will kill anything. They are very good at what they do. I am almost entirely terrified of crocodiles and alligators and anything. Not in a, oh my God, I don't want to near one. In a, I know what you can do, and I'm not going to push you.
I'm not going to mess with it.
Yeah, like I'm not going to mess with a hippo, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Like I value my life enough to not do that. You know, I recognize how good they are at killing. So that is the story of how the dinosaurs went extinct.
Oh.
But there's just one more thing.
Uh-oh.
It's a quick fire quiz.
Oh,
dun,
no.
Dun, dun, dun. End of the world edition.
I have retained nothing.
So the rules of the quick fire quiz are the same as always. I'll ask one question between the two of you. The first person to buzz in with the correct answer wins. What do they win, Jemp?
A big old tap from the asteroid.
No. Ooh. No, that would affect everyone. That's very bad.
Yes.
Get out of the way.
Luke, what's your buzzer?
Rawr!
Jemp, what's your buzzer? The question for you is, when did the dinosaurs go extinct?
Rawr!
Luke?
225 million years ago.
Not quite.
Oh.
Jemp?
Oh, rawr.
60 million years ago.
Oh, close.
Rawr. 90 million years ago.
No, Champ was closest.
Oh.
65 million years ago.
Literally one away.
66 million years ago.
Rawr. Ding, 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 that is correct. Well done. Roughly 66 million years ago is when we stopped seeing dinosaurs in the fossil record, hinting that they died out pretty quickly then. Obviously, dinosaurs did not go completely extinct because we have birds, avian dinosaurs, still kicking, still flying, very still nice, flapping, still swimming, all this cool stuff that birds do. But that is it from us this week. Before we go, we would like to thank all of our patrons with a very special thank you to executive producers Rosa Rodriguez and Danito. And thank you for watching. You can find the 4 references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday. And why not leave us a nice wee comment? You can support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, here on YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCory everywhere.
You can follow me at Jamkin everywhere.
You can follow me at Luke Cutforth everywhere.
Goodbye. Oh my God, what's that in the sky? It looks like it's 10 kilometers wide and coming down. Oh no!
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.